precisely where I had left him. Undine met me at the kitchen door.
"They've been looking for you everywhere," she announced. "They're furious, I can tell. Ibu wants to see you at once."
In ordinary circumstances, I would have responded to such a command by sending up a reply that would have given Undine's mother a perm that would be truly everlasting. But I restrained myself. There was enough pressure in the house already, without my adding more. And so, like a perfect little lady, I turned and walked gracefully up the stairs. I could hardly believe it. Dogger had billeted the Cornwall de Luces in a bedroom above the north front, a musty room with mouldy cream and green wallpaper, which made the room look like a cavern hung with Roquefort cheese. I knocked and entered before Lena could tell me to come in.
"Where have you been?" she demanded.
"Out," I said. I was not going to make this easy for her.
"Everyone has been looking for you," she said.
"Your father collapsed at the foot of your mother's coffin. It was dreadful."
"Dreadful?"
"What?"
I could scarcely believe it. "He wasn't to stand watch until this evening," I said.
"The poor man has barely left her side since they brought her into the house this morning. Your Aunt Felicity was with him. Her vigil ends at 6:48, and they want you to relieve her, to take your father's place."
"Thank you, Cousin Lena," I said. "I shall see to it." I stepped outside and quietly closed the door, leaving her to the Roquefort. Safely alone in the hall, I leaned against the wall and took a deep breath. I wasn't worried about Father. Dogger would have put him to bed, and I had no doubt that everything in that department was under control. Lena had made no mention of the doctor being called, so I was quite sure that it was a case of exhaustion, pure and simple. Father had barely rested since the news had come of Harriet's death, and now that she had been brought home to Buckshaw, he would be sleeping even less. What concerned me was this. With only a few hours to go before my watch began, there was little time to prepare. Kind fate had tripled the time I would have with Harriet. Instead of 4 hours and 48 minutes, I would now have more than 14 hours, albeit in 3 sessions, Father's, Feely's, and mine, interrupted by Daffy's, of course, to bring Harriet back from the dead. There would be one chance, and one chance only, to convince the family of my worth. If I failed, I would remain forever an outcast. There wasn't a second to waste. Everything now depended upon Flavia de Luce.
Chapter 16.
Alone in my laboratory, with the door firmly bolted, I began my final preparations. Esmeralda looked on from her perch, completely disinterested. The first step was to lay out a kit of the required tools. Screwdriver, tin snips, gloves, galvanized coal scuttle, and torch. The first of these items was to open Harriet's coffin. The second, to cut through the metal lining. The third and fourth, to receive whatever might remain of the dry ice in which I was counting on her being packed. And the fifth, to add more light to the scene than would be provided by the flickering candles alone. Then there were the hypodermic needles, 2 sturdy and somewhat suspicious specimens from Uncle Tar's truly comprehensive collection of laboratory glassware. I removed from my pocket and unwrapped from my handkerchief the 2 vials of adenosine triphosphate, which Dr. Darby had so generously contributed to my scheme, followed by the bottle of thiamine, which Annabella Cruikshank had handed over in open defiance of her brother, Lancelot. If Undine or Lena had noticed the peculiar bulges in my jumper, they had said nothing. Next, in preparation for the act itself, I reviewed the relevant pages from Uncle Tar's notebooks, those concerning the reanimation of the dead, the resurrection of Harriet de Luce. I pulled up a tall stool and began reviewing the spidery handwritten texts. It was obvious to even the most casual reader that Uncle Tar had actually experimented upon rabbits. Page after page was filled with his hand-drawn charts and graphs,
showing times, dosages, and results of his attempted resurrections of 24 rabbits, who had been given the names Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, and so on, all the way up to Omega. All of them, save Epsilon, who Uncle Tar suspected might have had a dicky heart to begin with, had been successfully revived from a state of clinical death and had lived to be experimented upon another day. My eyes were heavy, not helped by my uncle's minuscule handwriting, as they ploughed over the pages. Once or twice I nodded, recovered with a start, yawned several deep yawns, and I awoke, completely disoriented. The side of my face lay flat upon the laboratory bench in a puddle of drool. I shook my head groggily and rotated it upon my neck, trying to ease the dull headache that invariably comes with sleeping during the day. I unlocked the door and hurried to my bedroom to have a look at the clock. It was 6:44. I had slept away whatever little remained of the afternoon, and now had just 4 minutes to get to Harriet's boudoir and take up my post. I would have to sneak back later for my tools and supplies. With the speed of a music hall quick change artist, I removed my rumpled clothing and threw on my best black jumper and a clean white blouse. Long black stockings and a pair of detestable black goody-two-shoes completed the get-up. Using my fingers as a comb, I gave my hair a lick and a promise and straightened my pigtails. Too late for decent grooming, I rubbed the crusty sleep from my eyes, removed a smudge of dirt from my chin with a bit of spit, and made haste for the west wing.
"You're 2.5 minutes late," Aunt Felicity said, glaring at her wristwatch.
"I was held up by the crowd outside," I said, which had a morsel of truth in it. The straggling line of silent mourners still stretched along the upper hall, down the stairs, across the foyer, out the door, and, for all I knew, all the way into the village. I had asked the woman at the head of the queue, a stranger, I hastened to say, to wait a bit longer before entering. There was an urgent family matter that must be seen to before the public visitations resumed. She had stared unflinchingly at me with her offended duck eyes. To be honest, she gave me the fantods.
"Oops," I had wanted to shout in the woman's face. It was easier than saying orpiment, which was the layman's term for AS2, S3, or arsenic trisulfide. Before Aunt Felicity could reply, I changed the subject.
"I'm worried about Father," I said. "What happened to him? I thought he wasn't due to begin his vigil until now."
"He couldn't bear to stay away," Aunt Felicity said. She nodded towards Harriet's catafalque. "He came up the stairs with her and remained at her side until he crumpled. It's a jolly good thing I was here to go for help."
"Dogger?" I asked.
"Dogger," she said, and that seemed to be that, until she added, "Whom else would I send for?"
"Well, Dr. Darby, I should have thought."
"Pah," Aunt Felicity almost spat. "Dogger has better qualifications than half the medical men in the kingdom."
"Dogger?
Oh, don't look so shocked, girl, and close your mouth. It's not at all becoming. I thought you might have worked it out long before this."
"Well, I've always known he has buckets of medical knowledge, but it seemed..."
"Seemed isn't worth tuppence. How many solicitors, or publicans, jockeys or bishops, do you know who could set a broken femur or snick out a pair of infected tonsils?"
"None," I admitted.
"Precisely," Aunt Felicity said. "There it was all the time, wasn't it? As plain as the nose on your face."
She was taking such great delight in my ignorance that I thought for a moment she was going to crow. But everything fell suddenly into place. How many times in the past had Dogger described to me the most exact clinical details of various medical conditions? I couldn't even begin to count the occasions. Why is it, I wondered, that the facts closest to our noses are so often the most overlooked? I felt an absolute chump. Although I prided myself on being able to put two and two together, for most of my life I had been adding them up to get three. It was humiliating.
He was with Father in the prisoner of war camp, wasn't he? In Changi, in Singapore.
This was a bit of family history I had wheedled out of Mrs. Mullet and her husband Alf, in particles of gossip too small individually to draw attention to themselves.
Togga saved your father's life on more than one occasion, she said, her voice suddenly soft, and for that he paid the price.
The light of the flickering candles threw such shifting shadows upon Aunt Felicity's features that it seemed as if the hovering face of a stranger were telling the tale.
Your father had been sentenced to death by the Japanese. His crime? Refusing to name those men under his command who had been involved in planning an escape. I'm not going to tell you what they did to him, Flavia. It would not be decent.
She paused to let me realize what she had just said.
In spite of the primitive conditions, and using not much more than the utensils from a mess kit, Togga somehow managed to keep your father from bleeding to death.
My throat was instantly hard and dry. I could not swallow.
For his troubles, Togga was sent to work on the Death Railway.
The Death Railway, the brutal road that had been hacked by prisoners of war for more than 200 miles, through forbidding hills and jungles, from Thailand to Burma. I had looked with horror at the ghastly images in the old news magazines, the skeletal labourers, the haunted faces, the crude graves by the wayside. 100,000 dead. There was more, much more, some of it too sickening to read.
For Togga, Aunt Felicity went on, that was only the beginning. He was sent to work on what came to be known as Hellfire Pass, a notorious section of the line upon which he and his fellow prisoners were forced to dig through sheer rock, using little more than primitive tools and their own bare hands.
How awful, I said, aware even as I spoke of how trivial my words must sound.
Cholera broke out, as it often does under such appalling conditions. Dysentery, followed by starvation, followed by... In spite of his own shocking physical condition, Togga attempted to deal with the casualties.
She broke off suddenly.
I think it best at this point, Flavia, to bring down a curtain upon the scene. There are things too terrible to be described by mere words.
My brain understood what she was saying, even if I did not.
Your father and Togga did not meet again until the end of the war, when they were thrown together by chance at a hospital operated by the British Red Cross. They didn't recognize each other until a chaplain introduced them. The padre said later of their reunion that even God cried.
Please, Aunt Felicity, I said, I don't want to hear any more.
You're a wise child, she said. I don't want to tell you any more.
We stood there for a few more minutes, saying nothing. Then, without a word, Aunt Felicity turned and left the room, leaving me alone with Harriet.
Chapter 17. I listened at the door to the low hum of voices outside. Taking a deep breath and turning the knob, I stepped solemnly into the hall.
Ladies and gentlemen, I said. Friends, neighbours.
I was trying desperately to think how Father would phrase it.
I know that you've been waiting patiently for a very long time, and I can't tell you how much the family appreciates it, but I'm afraid that we're going to have to close the house for the rest of this evening. There are, as you can imagine, many details which must be seen to before my mother's funeral, and I...
An appeal to their imaginations seemed like an inspired touch, but still there was a murmur of disappointment.
It's all right, ducks, said the woman with the duck eyes,
and I nearly burst into hysterical laughter at my private joke.
We all know what you've been through.
She pronounced it through.
We all know what you've been through, so you don't have to tell us twice when to clear out. You're very kind, I said. I'm glad you understand. We shall resume in the morning at 9:15.
By that time, Daffy would be ending her shift, and I, for better or for worse, would have finished most of what I had come to do. If, as I hoped, history had been made in the night, tomorrow's early mourners would arrive to find the tomb empty, so to speak. It promised to be a most interesting day. The woman with the duck eyes had actually begun to walk away, but now she turned and called back to me, almost desperately.
"Miss Harriet babysat me and my sister once. Our ma'am was taken sudden with the appendix, and Miss Harriet, God bless her, made us brown sugar sandwiches."
I gave her a sad smile. Sad because I hated her. No, not hated. Envied her for the sudden stabbing memory of Harriet, who had never made brown sugar sandwiches, or any other kind for that matter, for me, at least that I could remember. My announcement was relayed from person to person back along the line. People began to turn reluctantly away, and in a few minutes the hall was empty. As the last few stragglers made their way down the west staircase, I slipped quietly through the baize door, which opened into the northwest corner of the house, and by a roundabout trek made my way to the east wing. Again, except for Lena and Undine, there was little danger of a personal encounter. Within minutes, I was on my way back from the laboratory, ticking off once more in my mind a list of the tools I had carefully laid out for myself. Tin snips, torch, gloves, screwdriver and coal scuttle, to say nothing of the ATP and the thiamine, which, wrapped in handkerchiefs, were stuffed safely into my pocket to keep from breaking or rattling. In the coal scuttle was a brass alarm clock I had brought from my bedroom, a last-minute addition which might have doomed the entire operation had it been forgotten. Back in Harriet's boudoir, I leaned thankfully against the door and heaved a sigh of relief. I hadn't been spotted. The lock gave a satisfying click as I turned the key, which I then removed and dropped into my pocket. "This is it," I thought, glancing at the clock. "Time to show them what you're made of, Flavia." It was 7:22. Time to remove the black pall with which Harriet's coffin had been draped. But before beginning my actual work, I replaced and relit each one of the now guttering candles at the head and foot of the catafalque. I would be needing all the light and all the heat they could generate. Dare lucem. The coffin screws were the easy part. Since they were new and had not been mouldering and rusting away in some damp old churchyard, they would be almost ridiculously simple to remove. In such a short time that it surprised even me, I had them loosened. Now came the moment of truth. "Saint Tancred, help me," I whispered. "Harriet, forgive me." And with that, I lifted the lid. It was as I had expected. Beneath the wooden lid was an inner coffin of zinc. Zinc for lightness, and although it was a somewhat harder metal than lead, still as easy as butter to cut through with the tin snips. Beneath the zinc, though, would be the face of my mother. What would she look like? I began to prepare myself mentally. I forced myself to think like a scientist. If her body was corrupt, I would go no further. There would be no point in it. But if, on the other hand, she had been preserved miraculously in the ice of the glacier, I would begin immediately my efforts to restore her to life. I worried a small hole in the zinc with the tip of the screwdriver and inserted one of the blades of the metal-cutting scissors. Snip. It was more difficult than I had thought. Snip. Already my thumb and forefinger were starting to feel bruised. A slight gush of wind, or was it my imagination, escaped from the coffin. I wrinkled my nose at the peculiar odour of soil, ice, and something else. Had there been the faintest whiff of Harriet's scent, Miratrix? Perhaps I was only willing it to be so. Snip. My fingers were already in pain, but I kept on cutting. After what seemed an eternity, I had made a three-sided incision of no more than a foot each side. If my calculations were correct, I was working directly over Harriet's face and chest. Careful, I thought. Mustn't damage her. It was at that precise instant that I realized I had forgotten a blowtorch. If I needed to reseal the inner coffin, I would have to solder shut the cuts I had made in the zinc. In order to do that, I would need not only the torch and a good supply of lead tin solder, but also a sufficient quantity of flux. The first two were easy enough. Uncle Tar had kept the laboratory stocked well enough with tools to keep from ever having to bring in overly inquisitive tradesmen to repair his plumbing. The flux, though, was another matter. I had planned to concoct it myself by killing a solution of hydrochloric acid and water with bits of zinc dropped into it. If I needed to do that now, it would require another trip to the lab and further delay. Snip. And then there was this. Although I had no fear of corpses, this one was obviously different. Would the act of coming face to face with my frozen mother result in some completely unforeseen shock to my system? There was only one way to find out. I inserted the screwdriver into the top edge of the cut and pried back the zinc with my fingers. A wave of weakness washed over me. I nearly fainted. There, just inches from my invading eyes, cradled in tendrils of curling gases, was the face of my mother, the long-lost Harriet. Except for a slight darkening of the end of her nose, she looked exactly as she had in all the photos I had ever seen. Fortunately, her eyes were closed. She had a tiny smile on her lips. That was the first thing I noticed. And her skin was as pale as that of any fairy tale ice princess. It was like coming face to face with an image of my older self in a frosty mirror. I was shaken with a shiver. Mother, I whispered. It's me, Flavia. She did not respond, of course, but it had been necessary to speak to her nonetheless. Something slipped and fell down beside her neck, a bit of solidified carbon dioxide. I had been right. They had packed her in card ice for the long trip home. Vapors were rising from the coffin, swirling briefly in the light of the flickering candles before cascading in slow drifts to the floor to form an ankle-deep mist. I touched her face with my forefinger. She was cold. How easy it is to say that, and yet so difficult to do. I became aware that my emotions were writhing inside me like snakes in a pit. Some part of me, of which I was not in control, made me bend over and kiss her lips. They were hard and as dry as parchment. Get on with it, Flavia, I was telling myself. You haven't a lot of time. I needed to know at the outset if there was any warmth, any heartbeat. There wouldn't be, of course, but I had to be sure. Every experiment must start with some basic given. Harriet was still dressed in the climbing gear in which she had been found, with an outer coat of tan-coloured gabardine that was already beginning to thaw, or at least to soften a bit from the heat of the candles. I unfastened a stiff button on her breast and worked a hand inside, feeling for her heart. As always, I had that brief irrational fear that I've had before with corpses, the feeling that the dead person is going to leap up suddenly, shout boo, and seize one's hand in a deadly grip of ice. Nothing of the sort happened, of course. What did happen was that among what felt like layered wool and silk and cotton, my fingers came into contact with something more substantial than fabric. I moved my hand as gently as possible. Whatever was tucked inside Harriet's clothing felt somewhat damp from the card ice and brittle. I seized it with the scissors of my first and second fingers and slowly worked it out and into the light. A large oilcloth wallet,
It was as rigid as frozen fish skin. I opened it with great care, but even so, several large flakes peeled off and fell away onto Harriet's breast. Inside was a single sheet of greyish, musty paper, water-stained and folded into four. My hands trembled as I flattened it out and read the penciled words. "This is the last will and testament of Harriet Deluce. I hereby give, devise, and bequeath to my..." Bang! I nearly leapt out of my hide. A thunderous knock at the door was followed by another, and another, and yet another. Bang, 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 bang! My immediate thought was that the noise would waken Father, whose bedroom was next door to Harriet's boudoir. Or had Dogger, perhaps, given Father something to make him sleep?
"Who is it?"
I called, my voice shaky in the sudden silence.
"It's Lena,"
came the hissed reply, muffled by the heavy panelling.
"Unlock this door and let me in."
I was too shocked to reply. Here I was, standing over an open coffin, nearly nose to nose with my mother's body, her last will and testament shaking in my hand. It was like a fevered nightmare.
"Flavia!"
"Yes?" It was all I could think of.
"Open this door at once."
Sometimes a very great shock has the effect of slowing down time, and this is exactly what happened. Almost as if disembodied, I watched myself shove the will into the wallet, drop it into the coal scuttle, close the zinc flap of the inner coffin, grab and replace a wooden lid from where I had leaned it against the wall, drape it with the black pall, shove the coal scuttle under and behind one of the heavy velvet hangings, turn the key and open the door, all in slow motion.
"What are you doing?" Lena demanded. "Why did you have this door locked?"
As if I hadn't heard, I sank to my knees on the carved prie-dieu that had been provided for those who might wish to offer their prayers for the repose of Harriet's soul. I hoped that it would look as if I had been there all along.
"What are you doing?" she repeated.
"Praying for my mother," I said, after a long enough pause. I crossed myself and got to my feet. "What is it, Lena?" I asked. "What's the matter?" One way of getting an immediate upper hand in a pinch is, as I have mentioned, to make use of an adult's name. "You frighten me," I added. Another way is to squeeze in an accusation, even a veiled one, before the other person has a chance to say a word.
"I thought I smelled smoke," she said. "It seemed to be coming from here."
"It's the candles," I said immediately. "They're awfully hot, and there are so many of them. With these heavy hangings," I waved my hand vaguely, "and with all the windows shut."
"I suppose," she said, sounding somewhat sceptical, but having a good look round the room nevertheless.
From where we stood near the door, everything appeared to be in order, every detail as it had been before I began. It was at that instant that my supersensitive hearing registered a new sound in the room. Drip. Drip. It was agonizingly slow, but as evident to my ears as a series of cannon shots. Surely Lena must be able to hear it.
"So, everything is all right then?" she asked.
I gave her a sad nod.
"Very well," she said,
but she made no move to leave. Rather, she looked slowly round the room as if satisfying herself that no stranger's ears were listening, although there might have been armies of eavesdroppers lurking behind the vast black velvet hangings.
"You will recall that I told you I was going to confide in you, Flavia, that I was going to seek your assistance. We were interrupted when that dreadful man terrified us with his aeroplane."
"Tristram Tallis," I said.
"Yes."
Drip. Drip. I knew at once where the sound was coming from. The card ice was melting, and drops of water were falling to the oaken floor of Harriet's boudoir.
"I told you, did I not, that Undine requires a very particular kind of handling?"
"Yes," I said.
"A very special kind of handling."
The candles closest to her face guttered in the peculiar hissing of her voice. A reflection danced on the floor, the merest flash of light under the catafalque.
It was water. Harriet's coffin was leaking. I needed to get Lena out of here as quickly as possible.
Undine likes you, she said. She thinks you're keen. That was her own word, keen. You're very good with her. I smiled indulgently. We need to talk. Not here, but somewhere where we can speak frankly, without fear of interruption. Do you know the jack-o'-lantern?
I did indeed.
It was a skull-like outcropping of rock to the east of Buckshaw that overlooked the palings, that somewhat sinister grove at a bend in the River Efon, which marked the eastern boundary of our estate.
Gladys and I had ridden there on many occasions, most recently to consult with Father's old headmaster, Dr. Isaac Kissing, who was a resident of Rook's End, a nearby private institution.
Yes, I said. I've heard of it.
It's at the end of Pooka's Lane, she said. Do you know where that is?
I nodded.
Excellent. We shall go there tomorrow afternoon at 3:30. We shall have a lovely picnic.
After the funeral? I asked.
After the funeral. I shall have Mrs. Mullet put up a hamper, and we shall make a day of it.
All right, I said, anxious to get rid of the woman. At that point, I think I would have agreed to anything.
I flung open the door to speed her departure.
Dogger, I said, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were there.
We had almost collided in the doorway.
It's all right, Miss Flavia, he said. No harm done. Mrs. Mullet wanted me to tell you that she's bringing up some cold meats. She has somehow formed the opinion that you haven't eaten today.
Lovely, just what I needed, a nice bit of brawn to tide me over my long night's work. Please thank her, Dogger, but I had something in the village this afternoon. I couldn't manage another bite.
I think it was the first time in my life I had ever lied to Dogger, and I think he knew it too.
Very well, he said, turning away.
If you don't want them, then I shall eat them, Lena said. I had almost forgotten she was there.
Dogger nodded but said nothing. He watched as she walked away towards the stairs and the kitchen.
Poor Mrs. Mullet, I thought.
Usually, by this time of day, she was safely home at her own hearth, with Alf. She must have stayed past her time to see to the funeral meats and so forth.
I must remember to take her aside later, I thought, and express my gratitude.
There was so much to be grateful for, when you stop to think of it, in spite of all our hardships.
Dogger, for instance.
This was the first time I had been alone with him since Aunt Felicity had told me his story.
How could I ever begin to thank him? How could I ever begin to make it up for what he had endured? What can one possibly say to a person who, in saving one's father's life, has been made to endure the tortures of the damned? I wanted to hug him, but of course I couldn't. It simply wouldn't do. We stood there together for a few moments. I was the first to speak.
God bless you, Dogger, I said at last.
God bless you too, Miss Flavia, he said.
I'm sorry, Dogger, I admitted. I didn't actually have anything to eat. But I'm not hungry, honestly.
I understand, he said, with rather a sad smile. I shall leave you to your task.
Only after he was gone did I think about what he had said.
Chapter 18. The evening was wearing on, and I had much to do. I turned the key in the lock, removed the pall from Harriet's coffin, and was preparing to lift the wooden lid when there was another knock at the door. I'm afraid I let slip a word which was not entirely suitable to the occasion. Well, I thought, at least I hadn't gone too far with my experiment. Better to be interrupted sooner than later. I replaced the pall, turned the key, and opened the door. There stood Father. He looked dreadful, as pale as if death itself were standing in the doorway.
I had thought he was in bed, sedated. Whatever could be so important as to cause him to arise? Or had he been awake all along? Behind him, in the hall, were two of the men I had seen on the station platform. They were not wearing their bowler hats, nor were they carrying their umbrellas, but I recognized them at once.
"This is my daughter Flavia," Father began,
but before he could finish, one of the two had brushed past both of us and into the boudoir. The taller one remained outside in the hall. I could now see that he was carrying a black bag, somewhat like Dr. Darby's, but considerably larger. I realized with a shock that I had seen his face before, and not just at the station. He had been pictured in the illustrated papers arriving in a trench coat at an old stone mortuary at the time of the Swindon suitcase murders. Now, here he was at Buckshaw, Sir Peregrine Darwin, the legendary Home Office pathologist, with his famous head of wild white hair and all. I could hardly believe it. What on earth could have brought him all the way down from London?
"My daughter Flavia," Father began again. "Flavia has been keeping—"
"Thank you, Colonel de Luce," Sir Peregrine said. "If we require further assistance, we shall send for you."
Send for him? Send for Father? In his own house? Who do these people think they are?
So gently that I hardly noticed it, Father took my arm and drew me out into the hall. The pathologist followed his colleague into the boudoir, and the green baize door swung shut behind them. The key turned with a determined click. Father and I were alone in the hall. I think he could see that I was working up a rage, but before I could say a word, he bent down, put his mouth close to my ear, and whispered,
"Home Office."
As if those two words explained everything.
"But why?"
Father put a forefinger to his lips to shush me, then crooked it and wiggled it as a signal for me to follow him. He opened the door of his bedroom and waved me inside. It was the first time I had been in Father's room in a year, but it was precisely as I remembered it, as if, like the British Museum, nothing was ever touched from age to age, but only stared at. The dark, heavy Gothic bed, the Queen Anne washstand, even the Stanley Gibbons stamp catalogue on the table seemed to have been suspended in time. Father waved me to a chair, and as I settled, he made his way across the room to a window. Windows, I believe, were as essential to Father's talking as his tongue. I waited for him to begin.
"We must do as they tell us," he said at last.
"But why?" I couldn't help myself. And yet, in my heart of hearts, I knew the chilling answer all too well. Sir Peregrine could have been sent here for only one reason.
"The Home Office is in charge now," Father said. "They have flown your mother home from Tibet, laid on the special train to bring her down to Buckshaw, and tomorrow they shall take her to St. Tancred's."
He did not add the words "after the autopsy," but he might as well have. His voice broke a little, but he steeled himself and carried on. I could almost see a pointer in his hand as he briefed me on what was undoubtedly to him a military campaign. A tragic one, to be sure, but a military campaign nevertheless. His face was white at the window as he said,
"At 1400 hours, your mother's coffin, draped again, in the Union Jack, will be brought down to the foyer, where it will rest for 10 minutes, to allow the household staff to pay their respects."
Household staff? Could he be referring to Dogger and Mrs. M?
Other than the various governesses, or VG as we called them, who were best not spoken about, there hadn't been household staff in the real sense of the word since I was a baby. "At 1415, the hearse, with the first of the floral tributes, will depart Buckshaw and arrive at St. Tancred's at 1422. The family will—"
Seeing that he was near to tears, or was it me? I walked softly across the carpet and stood by his side at the window.
"It's all right, Father," I said. "I understand,"
even though I didn't.
At that moment, I wanted more than anything to tell him about my accidental discovery of Harriet's will. The fact that it was thought Harriet had died without leaving a will had been at the center of our poverty-stricken existence for as long as I could remember. On several occasions, kind fate had seemed to dangle a financial solution under our very noses, only to snatch it away again as ruthlessly as if we were engaged in a rough-and-tumble round of hook the hanky. For instance, there had been the first quarto of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, which had turned up in the library, but which Father had steadfastly refused to part with, although a certain big name on the London stage, oh, all right, it was Desmond Duncan, continued to contrive new ways to get his scheming hands on the precious little volume. And then there had been the Heart of Lucifer, that priceless diamond which had once ornamented the crozier of St. Tancred, and which had been recovered at the village church just a week ago, during the occasion of the opening of his tomb. After vanishing for a while as it worked its way through my alimentary canal, the stone had come to light at last, so to speak, and had recently been handed over to the bishop for further investigation by the ecclesiastical authorities, who, after consultation with the Garter King of Arms, Somerset House, and the Public Record Office, were to make the final decision upon whether or not the 500-year-old St. Tancred de Lucy had been one of our de Luce ancestors, and hence whether the stone was ours in law, common, or otherwise.
"Don't hold your breath," the vicar had advised Father.
The discovery of Harriet's will, then, would be crucial. But even so, some strange new urge was keeping me silent. Why couldn't I just blurt it out and be done with it? The answer to that simple question was a complex one, and I wasn't sure I even understood it myself, although my reasoning went something like this. In the first place, I had no right to interrupt Father's mourning. Good news, it seems to me, has no place in the midst of tragedy, when it cannot be fully appreciated, when it is dampened and diluted by the atmosphere in which it is announced and robbed of its healing power.
"Catharsis cannot possibly come until the bitter end," Daffy had lectured us as she read aloud from Aristotle. "Then, too, there was the less than admirable fact that I wanted to keep the will's existence to myself for as long as possible. In some strange way, I needed to feed upon and relish the possession of information that nobody knew but me. I'm not really proud of that, but it's true. There is a strange strength in secrets which can never be achieved by spilling one's guts. With those thoughts in mind, I slipped my hand into Father's, and the two of us stood together in silence for what seemed like a comforting eternity. As we stood there at the window, my father and I fell into what Daffy would have called a reverie, and everyone else a brown study. Images floated dizzily into and out of my mind. Harriet and the cine film soundlessly forming the words pheasant sandwiches, those very same words in the mouth of Mr. Churchill, the horrible gleam of Harriet's coffin before it was mercifully shrouded by the Union Jack, the tall man at the window of the laboratory. The man, was it the same man, or at least his arm, sticking grotesquely out of the steam beneath the wheels of the train? His last words, his message to Father, the gamekeeper is in jeopardy. Had I done as he had asked? No, I hadn't. My only excuse was that the time hadn't been right. Whatever was I waiting for? If I couldn't give him good news, I could at least give him bad. It didn't make much sense, but there it was. "Father," I blurted, "that man at the station, the one who fell under the train, he told me to tell you that the gamekeeper is in jeopardy. He also said something about the Nide, but I'm afraid I missed it." Father was galvanized. The muscles of his face twitched as if he were wired up to an array of chemical batteries in some fiendish laboratory experiment. His eyes came slowly and jerkily around to focus on my face.
"Man? Station?
Train?" Could he have been so distracted by grief,
I wondered, that he didn't see or hear the accident? Or was it murder? Hadn't someone said that the stranger was pushed?
This man, Father asked, his face, if possible, even more grey than it had been. What did he look like?
He was tall, I said, very tall. He was wearing a heavy coat.
Thank you, Flavia, Father said, drawing himself up,
pulling himself visibly together as if he were an aged warhorse hearing the bugle call to battle.
And now, if you will excuse me, he said, I am freeing you from your vigil. You must go to bed now. We all of us have much to do tomorrow.
I was dismissed. There was no point in asking Father the meaning of the message. I would have to work it out for myself. And I knew exactly where to begin. The library door was shut, as I knew it would be. I gave 3 long scratches at the panel, with what was left of my bitten fingernails, followed by a pause, then 3 short, and 3 long again, the signal for a brief truce that Daffy and I had privately agreed upon in happier days. Even though we were not presently at war, it was best to go warily. If there was one thing that infuriated Daffy, it was being what she called a barger. A barger was one who burst suddenly into a room without so much as a kiss me quick and mind the marmalade, an invader of privacy, an insensitive clot, a thoughtless blockhead. And I'll admit that at one time or another I had been one or more of these, sometimes by accident, and other times not.
Come,
Daffy called, just when I was about to give it up. I opened the door with exaggerated care and stepped into the library. At first I couldn't see her. She was not draped across her usual armchair, nor was she sitting by the fireplace. Bleak House had been returned to the bookcase, and Paradise Lost was now turned turtle on the table. When I located my sister at last, I saw that she was standing at a window, staring out into the darkness. I waited to allow her the first word, but she said nothing. Father sent me to bed, I said. He's let me off my vigil early. Some men from the Home Office have taken charge.
They're everywhere, Daffy said. Mrs. Mallett says they've booked every last cranny at the 13 Drakes.
Better than sleeping at Buckshaw, I said, meaning it as a bit of a joke. Daffy snorted.
We're already bursting at the seams with unwelcome bodies.
It seemed an odd thing to say, and for an instant I was on the verge of asking if she included Harriet in that remark, but I restrained myself.
What with Lena Lardy-Dar-Deluce and that brat of hers, plus your precious Mr. Tallis?
He's not mine, I protested. I hardly know the man.
And your precious Adam Sowerby.
Adam Sowerby? I could scarcely believe my ears. I had met Adam, who claimed to be a flora archaeologist and inquiry agent, during a recent murder investigation in which I had been able to point the police in the proper direction. Even after I had solved the case, and he had more or less declared us partners in investigation, Adam had refused to tell me whom he was working for.
What's Adam Sowerby got to do with it?
I asked.
He's here, Daffy replied. Drove down from London, arrived a couple of hours ago. Doggers put him in one of the rooms in the Northwest Territories, with the rest of them.
The Northwest Territories was our playful name for that vast and desolate expanse of unused bedrooms, whose few remaining sticks of furniture were kept draped with dusty sheets, awaiting some distant and unlikely day when Buckshaw might be restored to its former fortunes. Unlike the abandoned and decaying East Wing, in which, by choice, I worked and slept.
No room at the inn, and so forth, Daffy said.
He and Father are old friends, remember? So I suppose that makes it all right for him to be a barger.
Her bitterness surprised me. Father probably needs old friends right now, I said.
Father needs a good shaking, she exclaimed,
and as she turned abruptly away from the window, I could see the tears in her eyes. I was suddenly as tired as if I had trudged barefoot across the Sahara Desert. It had been a brutally long day.
My parched mind was shocked to hear my mouth uttering words I never thought would cross my lips.
Chin up, Daff. We'll come through all this. I promise.
Chapter 19. I slept the sleep of the damned, tossing and turning, as if I were lying in a bed of smouldering coals. Whenever I did manage to doze off, my mind was filled with tattered dreams. Dogger, standing atop a hill, his white hair and his gardener's apron flying and flapping in a wicked wind. Feely and Daffy as little children, watching a Punch and Judy show in which all the puppets, except the hangman, had blank, formless faces. Harriet floating on an iceberg, paddling furiously with her hands to escape an Arctic tidal wave. I jerked awake to find myself sitting bolt upright, a strangled cry in my throat. My mouth tasted as if a farmer had stored turnips in it while I slept. I looked around in panic, for a moment not knowing where I was. It was that hour of the very early morning when all the world has begun to float to the surface of sleep, but has not yet really come awake. I cupped my hands behind my ears and listened for all I was worth. The house was in perfect stillness. As I swung my feet out of the warm bed and onto the cold floorboards, my brain came instantly up to full throttle.
The will! Harriet's will!
I had shoved it into the coal scuttle and put it out of my mind. I had to retrieve it, and there wasn't a moment to lose. I was dressed in a flash and creeping as stealthily as a cat burglar towards the west wing. Dogger, who had difficulty sleeping, would soon be up and about. Not that I wanted to hide anything from him. No, far from it. What I did want to do was to shield him from blame. There are a few instances in life where, in spite of everything, one has to swallow one's heart and go it alone, and this was one of them. I had left the torch in Harriet's boudoir and would have to rely on the weird half-light that was coming in through the windows at the end of the hall. Sunrise, I judged, would not be for another 3/4 of an hour. Soundlessly, I crept along the passageway, giving praise at every silent step for the invention of carpets. The soles of my bare feet could feel the grit left behind by yesterday's parade of mourners, and I made a mental note to get out the carpet sweeper before breakfast and give the rug a jolly good cleaning. It was the least I could do. At the entrance to Harriet's boudoir, I put my ear to the door and turned up the sensitivity. Not a sound. I put my hand on the knob and nothing.
It didn't budge.
The door was locked and the keys were inside. For a brief, crazy moment, I thought of fetching a ladder and scaling the outer wall, but I remembered that every one of the boudoir's windows was firmly shut and locked. The only other way into the room was through Father's bedroom. I would need to slip in without knocking, tiptoe to the door which connected to Harriet's boudoir, then enter and leave without a sound. I retraced my steps in perfect silence. At Father's door, I inhaled as much air as my lungs would hold. I turned the knob, and the door opened. I stepped inside and began my long trek across the room. As my eyes became accustomed to the lesser darkness, a lighter patch in the corner showed that Father's pillows were untouched.
His bed was empty.
I froze in my tracks and let my eyes move slowly round the room.
He was nowhere to be seen. Had he gone to his study?
This was, after all,